The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Millions at Stake as Triangle Business Activists Spar Over RDU Land. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. A swath of forest land in Research Triangle Park has become a battleground. On one side stands a family with a long history in the Triangle, the Brattons, the patriarchs of Rock Crusher Wakestone Corporation. The other, a group of very loud activists holding signs that say, Save RDU Forest. The trouble? RDU Forest doesn't actually exist, officials say. It's not a park, says Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority CEO Mike Landguth. It's never been a park. What it is, he says, is a financing opportunity, which is why the airport is leasing the 105 acres to Wakestone as an expansion of their quarry. Activists disagree. It's an issue that has been fought over at City Hall, in the RDU boardroom, and through thousands of petition signatures. At stake in this fight could be more than $350 million over 25 years for Wakestone, and as much as $24 million for RDU, big money with large repercussions. It will ultimately be decided in the courtroom. Bratton's Request. In Knightdale, the Brattons are known for community service. In addition to donating land for the environmental park near Town Hall and an in-progress soccer complex, anything the town asks, we generally do it, company president Sam Bratton says. They've supported community organizations for decades. Bratton can still recall how his father hosted school tours in the 1980s and said yes to fire department fundraisers. A framed photo of a fire truck paid for with Wakestone funds is displayed in the lobby. He admits the advocacy doesn't extend as heavily to Raleigh proper, but he doesn't think philanthropy would dissuade critics of the project. He blames misinformation, saying that even the blasts are as dramatic as described. By those waving RDU signs. In a fleece Patagonia vest and worn brown cowboy boots, Bratton stands balancing on a dusty rock pile, staring into the vast chasm that took his family 50 years to create. It's bigger than a football field and tiered with 40-foot ledges, the product of more than 50 years of shots, where deep drills drop tens of thousands of explosives in the recesses of the stone twice a week, causing a two-second explosion and a puff of smoke. The loosened rock is shoved away by machines, crushed through massive jawbreakers with giant metal plates, aided by mammoth crane-like structures. It's loaded onto black dump trucks, 500 a day from Knightdale. The trucks bring the material to construction sites and road crews, all within a 15-mile radius of the quarry. Project Fortify, parts of 540, the rock originated here, in the 50-year-old quarry pit hidden, yet just feet from Knightdale Town Hall. When the trucks hit the highway, rolling past the on-site horse pasture and historic farmhouse restored, but the original structure that was on the property when the Brattons took it over in 1970, they're the only visible parts of Wakestone Corporation. From the road, all drivers can see is a white farmhouse, added as Wakestone's headquarters in the 1980s, and the occasional dump truck turning right at the stoplight. We try not to look like we're here, Bratton says. In Knightdale, the quarry has hundreds of years left to crush rock, much of its acreage still untouched by the industrial machines. A few miles away, it's a different story. The company's Triangle Quarry, whose stone may have literally built Cary, is outliving its usefulness, at least according to the paperwork on file with regulatory agencies. Capacity is starting to dwindle. Its peak staff of 30 shrunk to 20 in recent years, he says. With land prices and size constraints, it's doubtful a new quarry will ever be an option for a company, such as Wakestone in Wake County. And that's a problem, because quarries generally have a 15-mile radius, and the farther they are from the project, the more expensive the stone costs to ship. With just 8 quarries split among 3 companies in the Triangle, the demand for local rock is already outpacing the supply, he says. But the Brattons have a plan. Just across the road from Triangle Quarry sits an unused portion of land, too small for a new quarry but perfect for an extension of their current operation. While it's early, it appears to have all the features Wakestone seeks: isolation, access, and an owner willing to sign a lease in February. But while that owner, Raleigh-Durham International Airport, is willing to deal, the same can't be said for a group of quote-unquote trespassers, as Wakestone officials call them. Opponents include cyclists and Umstead State Park enthusiasts, some of whom admit to trespassing on the trails once used by Boy Scouts. The land itself is dubbed the Odd Fellows Tract, named for its long-past owners. RDU acquired it decades ago, telling stakeholders the acreage was needed for a new runway. But plans changed, as did the alignment of the runway, and today it's covered with trees and just far enough from the interstate to make those trespassers forget they're in the fast-growing triangle. For the airport, it's an opportunity for revenue, estimated at $24 million. But that's nothing, says Umstead State Park Executive Director Gene Spooner, Wakestone's loudest opponent, pointing to the billions airport officials say they need to keep pace with growth. And it's not a guarantee, she says. Wakestone's journey. For the Brattons, a new quarry doesn't just continue the business, it continues a family legacy. Wakestone has five quarries crushing rock, and all but Triangle Quarry have decades, and in some cases centuries, worth of rock to grind. But Triangle has about 5 years left. A new digging operation at the RDU land takes about 2 years to perform due diligence and permitting. The 105-acre swath across from their current operation is a niche of land that, to another quarry firm, wouldn't even be considered. To be profitable, firms like Bratton's typically look for sites at least 300 acres today, something he says he wishes his father had done when assembling Triangle Quarry all those years ago. Wakestone began on a swath of farmland on what was then out in the country in Knightdale. The Bratton patriarch, John Bratton, had been vice president of operations at Martin Marietta when the firm was rapidly expanding. His son, Sam Bratton, recalls fears that he could be transferred. But John Bratton, a father of seven children, didn't want to leave North Carolina. So, with John Bratton Jr. as employee number one, he started Wakestone. The senior Bratton had experience. He'd worked at Superior Stone, which became Martin Marietta, since leaving World War II. He thought he'd get one operation going and he'd make a good livelihood, Bratton says. He didn't think much further beyond that. But as the rock started crushing, the demand started building. The first big break started when Wakestone won a contract to supply the Sharon Harris Nuclear Power Plant. In 1974, the Brattons opened a site in Moncure to accommodate. When that operation slowed, he went to the survey table, eyeing other opportunities, and that's when he found what would become Triangle Quarry near RDU. He got some real estate folks in Raleigh to put together parcels of land that fell between RDU Airport property and Umstead Park, Bratton says. When Triangle scored its mining permit in 1981, Wakestone shut down its Moncure operation, moving it to the Triangle Quarry, where demand would continue to build. Triangle Quarry was taking off just as Cary was booming, and immediately plans were made to upgrade the plant, Bratton says. Wakestone would reopen Moncure, it would open a Nash County quarry near Rocky Mount, and in the 2000s it would start to crush rock at an operation in North Myrtle Beach, making five operations altogether. And it was a family-run business. Johnny, the board chairman, was the first employee. Ted, the middle brother, 8 years Johnny's junior, would become CEO. And Sam, 8 years younger than Ted, would become company president. John Bratton Sr. used to joke that it was a long-range plan all along to space out his sons for his company. We'll continue to fight. For Spooner, it's personal, too. The Umstead State Park was her first real introduction to the Triangle in 1976. She camped there while interviewing for graduate school at NC State University, where she would go on to be a professor with an expertise in water quality issues. But her advocacy goes back much further. Spooner was the kid behind the first environmental club at her grade school in Webster, New York. She was the girl who developed her school's first recycling program, rallying her teachers to let her crush the cans in the lunchroom. Every day, to much amusement and pleasure of the cook staff, she says. And she won't stop until plans for the rock quarry expansion are squashed. I understand where she's coming from, Bratton says. She has to do what she has to do, and I have to do what I have to do. The Bratton clan and Spooner have clashed before, but they've also collaborated, It was Wake Stone that donated much of the crushed rock lining the trails at Umpstead, and Bratton has admired what Spooner has accomplished at Umpstead State Park. Spooner has worked to improve the stormwater runoff situation, crafting a rain garden to keep polluted storm runoff from Umpstead streams. The group stopped a highway from cutting through the park in the 1980s. Her group is still working to restore the park's old structures, including an old mess hall. Knowing the current Triangle Quarry was winding down was welcomed, Spooner says. She and others had hoped that when the facility shut down for good, it could perhaps serve as a park expansion. But when mining shifts to Odd Fellows, the current quarry will be needed to provide access and infrastructure, frustrating those hopes. Wake Stone is effectively 500 large trucks a day coming off our main park entrance right now, so it's really a trucking facility and it's not a very aesthetic neighbor, she says. The quarry does not make a good neighbor to a state park, and we've long looked forward to when this quarry is no longer in operation. We believe it is in violation of the commitments the airport has to its owners and the community to ignore a massive amount of public outcry who are opposed to putting a quarry onto our public lands. She fears the amazingly beautiful, quiet sanctuary off Company Mill Trail will be destroyed. We have a whole section of our park that is serene now, and that will be totally destroyed with noise and ambience, she says. The bottom line is this is some of the most environmentally sensitive forest land, and we want to protect it. RDU's Dilemma. Landguth, CEO of the Airport Authority since 2011, says the stakes are high for the region's airport, too. Its passenger numbers are growing faster, much faster, than anyone had predicted. The current volumes put it 8 years ahead of what was outlined in the airport's overall master planning process. And if the growth continues, and it will, he says, that means another $1 billion in improvements will be needed in the next 20 years. A plan that was about $2.7 billion is almost $3.7 billion today, Landguth said, speaking at a specially called budget workshop in front of the Airport Authority board in March. It means we need to continue to be aggressive in terms of growing income, and part of that income, he said, will come from the swath of land known as Odd Fellows. He's been here before, as has his seasoned board, today led by real estate developer John Kane of Kane Realty. 2 years ago, when Wake Stone first made its offer public, there was outcry. RDU reeled in outside legal help to assist in meandering through regulatory issues, officials said at the time. They held public workshops where brightly colored concepts tested out the quarry label. Activists, not content to just print signs, pulled in their own outside attorneys. Armed with experts, groups such as the Umpstead Coalition and Triangle Off-Road Cyclists came together to form a committee. They developed what they called an alternative plan, RDU Forest. Could be an urban trail center, they said at the time. It could attract outdoor-focused businesses. Emails were passed around touting similar projects around the country, anchored by brands such as Patagonia and REI. But the plan was never seriously discussed by the actual decision-makers, the board, and an alternative offer from the Conservation Fund, a letter of intent outlining a proposal to buy the land, was rejected outright because RDU was only looking at lease bids. The public outcry was heavy and distracting, Landguth would later say. The airport was at a crucial moment. Behind the terminals, a 10,000-square-foot runway, the strip serving RDU's two transatlantic flights was nearing the end of its useful life, and that had to be the priority, Landguth recalls. So Kane made a motion, rejecting all offers, Wake Stone's included. But as environmentalists were celebrating, Wake Stone was returning to the table. Within weeks, it had approached airport officials again, hoping to come up with a compromise. So Landguth returned to the board, he says. While the board told him to concentrate on the runway, it didn't tell him to cut off conversations with Wake Stone. Instead, Landguth was told to get Wake Stone to reach out to stakeholders. The rock crusher was told to engage with the community, and once it had, it could come back. Sam Bratton says Wake Stone made an effort. In addition to a 2018 presentation to Wake County commissioners, the quarry has hosted multiple tours, from business executives to environmentalists themselves. He says it's an effort of transparency to show them that Wake Stone is being a good neighbor. And armed with what he hoped was a compromise, Bratton again attended a specially called board meeting at RDU in March. But this time there was no discussion, despite a pulsing crowd of activists with Save RDU Forest signs. After a 15-minute presentation, the board voted to approve the lease of Wake Stone, and between shouts of shame, activists in the crowd vowed it wasn't over. Within weeks, they'd filed a lawsuit challenging the process. As is described by Spooner, the entities that own the airport, Wake County, Durham County, the City of Raleigh, and the City of Durham, should have gotten a vote. That stance is rejected by RDU's attorney, but as part of the litigation, the plaintiffs won a temporary restraining order that prohibits Wake Stone from commencing quarry operations. The order does not, however, apply to the exploratory drilling that's underway, nor is it expected to alter Wake Stone's current plans. Bratton estimates a quarry wouldn't happen for about 2 years, even without the order. Battle mired in litigation. On April 29, RDU officials announced that the airport had received a letter from the Federal Aviation Administration, and one its officials claim gives the airport authority, the all-clear, to proceed with its land lease to Wake Stone. According to a statement from RDU, the FAA determined that the lease does not involve federal funding and will not adversely impact airport operations. But the fight is far from over. Wake Stone and RDU plan to tussle with the litigation aggressively in court. RDU has already filed a counterclaim against one of the named plaintiffs, Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, accusing it of trespassing on the Odd Fellows tract. Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, through spokesman Dave Anderson, says his group does not advocate trespassing, but some of the sign holders protesting the lease signing in March told Triangle Business Journal they were with the group and that they had been using the unsanctioned trails for decades. So did some of the Umstead Coalition's advocates who have been appearing at Triangle events, such as the Expo for the recent Tobacco Trail Marathon. Anderson says that's against his group's official position, as does Spooner. There are at least tens of thousands of cyclists in the Triangle, and of course we can't and don't control what they say, Anderson says. While both Anderson and Spooner say they want more trails in the Triangle, neither characterize what Wake Stone has proposed as a compromise. Under the proposal, Wake Stone agrees to pay $3.6 million toward a potential mountain bike park at a site nearby, known as the 286 parcel. Wake Stone will pay another $3 million to transition the site for recreation once mining is complete. It's the details that Spooner finds irksome, such as the trail lease included in the compromise. She questions what happens once that lease expires and theorizes an answer. She thinks Wake Stone plans to expand outside of the Odd Fellows lot and onto a nearby 150-acre site, one that could keep the quarry going for decades to come. She points to nearby Lake Crabtree County Park, leased by RDU to the county, and wonders if that tract, too, might one day be developed. She fears trails will be shifted from Lake Crabtree to the new park, leaving space for office complexes. Wake Stone, for its part, claims no conspiracy. Officials say their plan begins and ends with Odd Fellows. And Wake County Commissioner Sig Hutchinson, who has stated his repeated support for Wake Stone's plan, says there's nothing to stop the county from pursuing a long-term lease for cyclists. We could get a 30-year lease, he says. If the Brattons are allowed to move forward, it will be a lengthy, permit-filled process with additional opportunities for public outcry. Bratton says he's trying not to think about that and is instead analyzing the opportunity at hand. While he says Wake Stone is confident the site is ideal for a quarry, it's not a guarantee. Months of due diligence sit between Wake Stone and a final decision. And we'll stop there as the rest of the article details how this will be a long process and some of the issues involved as far as what happens after a quarry ends, and which it usually becomes a park. Prime location in center of Chapel Hill sold. This is written by Cliff Barnes. A landmark building in the center of Franklin Street in Chapel Hill has been sold to a developer planning to reposition the property as an opportunity zone for startup companies. The Central, located at 137 East Franklin Street, has been sold to Grub Properties, which has offices in Charlotte, Cary, Lexington, and Atlanta. The deed recorded with Orange County indicates that the purchase price was $23.5 million. The 100 block of East Franklin Street is the main corner of the street and directly across from UNC Chapel Hill. The sale includes the attached building that faces Rosemary Street, as well as the 276-space parking deck across the street at 125 East Rosemary Street. Originally built in 1972 and once known as Bank of America Plaza, the Central now features a CVS, the largest pharmacy near campus. The ultimate fate of CVS is unclear, as Grubb is looking to make the property an entrepreneurial hub that will provide tax benefits to qualifying businesses in opportunity zones. But CVS will remain open during renovations. One of the largest buildings in the area, the Central has three stories that fronts Franklin Street. UNC Chapel Hill also leases space in the building. The assessed value of the building and land stands at more than $13.5 million, while the assessed value of the parking lot is more than $2.5 million. The seller, 137 East Franklin LP, Zapolsky Real Estate of Durham, purchased the property in 2014 for $28.7 million, according to an Orange County deed records. The purchase by Grubb Properties continues a trend in Chapel Hill, where many of the town's iconic structures along Franklin Street are owned by people or firms with North Carolina ties. Across the triangle, national outfits have been spending millions on properties in Raleigh and Durham, but that wave has yet to hit Chapel Hill. Trinity Partners, a commercial real estate service company with offices in North and South Carolina, marketed the property on behalf of the seller. Investor appetite for the asset was strong, given the outstanding regional market fundamentals as well as the dearth of available value-add investment opportunities market-wide, said Trinity Partners' Mark Alviano of the Raleigh office. This offering was extremely well-received given its combination of size relative to the Chapel Hill market, as well as the associated upside inherent in the opportunity zone designation, he said. Grubb Properties, the buyer, was founded in 1963 in Davidson County with a few homes and apartments, but has aggressively grown since the 1990s. Grubb is in the process of constructing a new office building at another Chapel Hill property, Glen Lennox Shopping Center, which was built in 1953. Eventually, that property could also be home to new apartments and a hotel. Another $100 million safety net set for this Triangle Pharma. This article is written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. The management and the board wanted to make sure the runway was clear of fiscal challenges, so they went and did something about it. Just days following the commercial launch of its second drug, Aery Pharmaceuticals has negotiated an additional $100 million of credit line, which its CEO says will soothe investors and allow the company to continue its drug development work while waiting on profits. The Durham-based company, NASDAQ AERI, has amended its existing credit agreement with Deerfield Management to double its available line of credit from $100 million to $200 million. Added to the total, $202.8 million cash and cash equivalents. Aery is now playing with around $400 million for 2019, says CEO Vincent Anito. "It's the most amount of money we've had access to ever in the history of our company," he says. "The reason we're doing this is that see huge opportunities to continue growing our pipeline as we build revenues," he said. Under the terms of the agreement, Aery may borrow up to $100 million in one or more borrowings prior to July 2020. Aery focuses on developing treatments for glaucoma, retinal diseases, and other eye diseases. In March, it received FDA approval of Rocklatin less than a year following the launch of its first drug, Rupressa. Both drugs are for the treatment of glaucoma. The company began selling Rocklatin at the beginning of the month, and Anito said its potential success is part of the reason the company wanted to secure more capital. "We just want to make sure we had enough capital in the organization if we do catch a flyer and Rocklatin takes off like we're expecting it to, and pull Rupressa up with it," he says. "We see an awful lot of actives not only to continue development of drugs we already have in the pipeline, but also begin activities on the business development side to do even more things that we can work on." The company had already kept its pipeline active. This month, it announced it received the go-ahead from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to begin clinical trials for its now lead drug candidate, AR-13503, a sustained-release implant for the treatment of retinal disease. The company plans to begin its first in-human clinical studies in the second quarter of this year. Anito says the company plans to finance AR-13503, which is expected to have a much longer, costlier path ahead through profits. Anito expects the company to be profitable by the end of next year. In 2018, the company reported net losses of $233.5 million, with $24 million in revenue. The company has said it estimates more than $110 million in revenue this year. It currently employs about 400 people across the country. Anito says another major reason for adding the additional credit was to give the company a buffer to continue taking advantage of business opportunities without shortening its runway and scaring investors. We didn't want to get caught in a situation where all of a sudden we did back-to-back business development deals and all of a sudden we spook Wall Street and they say, oh my God, they're going to run out of money, they're going to do financing, he says. This gives us a huge amount of runway. It takes the worry off of anybody having to think about whether we're going to do some sort of equity financing they're all freaked out about. Adding that security does cost the company a couple of $1 million at the least, but Anito says the safety net is well worth it. The additional credit includes an interest rate on drawn amounts of LIBOR plus 7.2% up to a maximum rate of 13%. The additional credit line may be terminated by ARI at any time for a fee of $2.6 million if undrawn or $5.2 million if any amounts have been withdrawn. It's pretty close to market. We do compare it to all sort of different financing options we have, Anito says of the borrowing rate. Remember, we don't have to do this. We're not forced to activate it. So this gives us flexibility, and we just don't think the interest rates are going to be damaged in the near future. It's really just a 12-month period where we're at risk for runaway inflation. I really just don't think it's much of a risk. Dude Solutions CEO talks growth opportunity behind private equity buyout. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Cary-based Dude Solutions is being bought out by California private equity investor. Clear Lake Capital Group has signed a deal to acquire the company from its current owner, Warburg Pincus. These are growth investors, says Dude Solutions CEO Ed Roschich in an interview. We've got such a huge growth opportunity in front of us. Clear Lake, whose executives were not available for interviews, was not the only suitor. Roschich says the firm got a ton of inbound inquiries in 2018, both about investment opportunities and outright buyouts. So we picked our heads up at the end of last year and decided to formalize a process, he says. Dozens of entities showed initial interest. Roschich describes a grueling process filled with 15-hour workdays, jet-setting throughout the country to whittle down the list of potential parents. Ultimately, it came down to shared vision, he says. Clear Lake, like Dude Solutions, saw the growth opportunities ahead, he says, and they're willing to make the investments necessary to make it happen, he adds. We're going to have an opportunity to grow the company faster, he says. They bought the management team. They bought the vision of the company. They love our space. They love what we're doing. And Roschich, who, along with the rest of the current management team, will continue to lead the company, is investing more than his professional commitment. He admits to throwing some of my life savings in with our new investors, though he declined to offer financial details. Previously, he had equity options that he hadn't utilized. As part of this buyout, he's adding from his own piggy bank, he explains. I believe we've got a huge opportunity to grow our company, become an even bigger force in the job market here in the Cary area, he says. We've got a great future ahead of us. And Clear Lake, which has managed more than $8 billion of institutional capital since its 2006 inception, adds to the potential, he says. Clear Lake's portfolio is peppered with technology firms such as security software firm Compudyne Corporation and aerial imagery firm Eagleview. The California firm claims to have invested in more than 100 companies. What sold our management team was the chemistry fit, the culture fit, he says. It felt like we were talking with long-lost brothers and sisters. They actually believe in our vision just as vehemently as we do. If all goes well, the deal could close in June. Dude Solutions, formerly called School Dude, develops cloud-based operations management software, helping companies keep full track of their facilities. The firm boasts of more than 12,000 clients in the education, government, healthcare, and manufacturing verticals, and it's been doing deals on its own of late, having acquired the Energy Center software platform from New Energy Technology earlier this week. That deal gave Dude Solutions a new energy business unit and a fifth office location in North America, Olympia, Washington. Warbug Pincus entered the picture in 2014, agreeing to invest up to $100 million in Dude Solutions, a first for what, up until that point, had been a bootstrapped company. At the time, Kent Hudson and Lee Provost, who founded the company in 1999, said the capital would triple the firm's then 220-person headcount in Cary over the next 5 years. And they've been true to their word, reporting 660 in headcount today, according to a company spokeswoman. Dude Solutions has been a mainstay at local job fairs in recent years, including those sponsored by the North Carolina Technology Association. It is great to have a market-leading company like Dude Solutions based here in North Carolina, North Carolina Technology Association CEO Brooks Rayford said after the deal announcement Friday. They have been an industry pioneer, and their appeal to potential acquirers demonstrates that. Cooper Standard to cut North Carolina jobs. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. A manufacturer has disclosed to the state that it plans to shutter an eastern North Carolina facility and ship the work to Canada. Cooper Standard Automotive, a Michigan-based supplier of systems and components for the automotive industry, has announced plans to close its plant in Goldsboro in October, a move that means 115 layoffs. Cooper Standard continually analyzes plant utilization to optimize our manufacturing footprint, the notice provided by the North Carolina Department of Commerce reads. Customer vehicle volume and mixed dynamics around the world, along with runout of existing business at the Goldsboro facility, have impacted our manufacturing facilities. As certain jobs will be transferred to an existing facility in Canada, the company plans to file the appropriate paperwork with the U.S. Department of Labor. In a prepared statement, Cooper Standard said it would work with employees to provide services to help make the transition for all affected employees as smooth as possible. To the extent possible, the company will provide alternate employment opportunities at other Cooper Standard locations, the statement adds. On an earnings call with analysts this week, Jeff Edwards, chairman and CEO, said the company recognized a need to aggressively manage our cost structure. We've already taken many proactive measures to rationalize headcount and operations, concentrate administrative functions in best-cost countries, streamline our management structure, eliminate non-essential IT projects, and many more, he told analysts. The result has been significant reduction in costs already, but more will be required. Cooper Standard announced plans in 2011 to add 137 jobs in Goldsboro in exchange for state incentives worth more than $157,000. At the time, the company already employed nearly 400 people in the region at two plants producing extrusion, notching, and molding processes for the automotive weather strip market. Streets at South Point Mall adds Italian-American eatery to its lineup. This is written by Dathan Kazak. A new restaurant and entertainment outfit is on its way in Durham. In a partnership with Brookfield Properties, Italian-American cuisine restaurant and entertainment concept Pinstripes Incorporated will be opening inside the streets at South Point in Durham. Pinstripes, alongside food, wine, and cocktails, also combines bowling and bocce ball to its repertoire. Our retail properties are a hub for daily life, and today's consumers expects a great experience that features dining, entertainment, and celebrates community, says Sandeep Mathrani, CEO of Brookfield Properties and vice chair of Brookfield Property Group. Founded in 2007 in Chicago, Pinstripes currently has 10 locations nationwide, including locations in Minnesota, Maryland, Kansas, Texas, and Ohio. Known for its dynamic event spaces that can cater groups of 20 to 1,000, Pinstripes will include an expansive outdoor patio. We're excited to work with Sandeep and his team to further transform the retail experience and offer our guests a magical venue to connect with each other, says Pinstripe CEO Dale Schwartz. Our unique combination of dining and entertainment is an ideal tenant for Brookfield Properties, and this partnership will further enable Pinstripes to accelerate its expansion plans, opening over 100 locations throughout the U.S. and overseas over the next several years. Pinstripe recently hired Susan Walmsley, a former vice president of marketing with Dallas-based Top Golf, and Rob Hentz, former head of real estate at both Apple and Crate & Barrel, as its chief development officer. Brookfield Asset Management currently manages over $285 billion in assets under management. Canes ticket prices soar again as Game 4 approaches. This is written by Dane Huffman. If you want to see a bunch of jerks on the ice, get ready to shell out some serious cash. On Friday night, the Carolina Hurricanes returned to PNC Arena for the fourth game of their second-round playoff series with the New York Islanders in a 7 p.m. contest. Tickets remain available on StubHub, but the lowest price is $160 as of 1 p.m., and that's for a ticket in the upper reaches of Section 328, which is one of the upper corners. Most tickets in the upper bowl cost upwards of $170 per ticket. Lower bowl tickets are much more expensive. They start at $225 and go all the way to $572 at center ice. The Canes lead the series 3-0 and can wrap up a spot in the Eastern Conference Finals with a win in the fourth game. Interest in the team has been intense as the Hurricanes make their first playoff appearance since 2009. Carolina has ranked near the bottom in the NHL in attendance in recent seasons, but that hasn't been an issue now as fans have packed PNC Arena. First GE, now Lighting Science Group, Cree faces another infringement allegation. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. As Durham semiconductor giant Cree works to close the sell-off of its lighting division, it's being hit with yet another patent infringement allegation. Already facing federal litigation lobbed by industrial giant General Electric, Cree was just named the defendant in a similar federal complaint filed by competing Rhode Island-based lighting manufacturer Lighting Science Group Corporation in Wisconsin. Cree, in the midst of divesting its lighting business to Ideal Industries in a $310 million deal, has again been accused of infringing on LED lighting patents. The company didn't immediately respond to a request to comment on the case, but doesn't typically make statements about ongoing litigation. LSG claims to have been the first U.S. manufacturer to make an LED light commercially available, releasing a lamp through a partnership with Home Depot in 2010, according to the suit. LSG claims Cree, either with knowledge or with willful blindness, is infringing on its patents by manufacturing and distributing certain LED lighting products. Through its attorney, Bradley Caldwell of Caldwell Cassidy Curry, LSG is asking the court for a judgment requiring Cree to pay damages. Litigation like this could complicate its ongoing deal with Ideal, announced in March. The best time to sue a competitor is when they're trying to get a deal done, because you can screw up both Cree and the potential buyer by throwing a big ugly piece of mud in the middle of their beautiful deal. Innovative Capital Law founder Jim Verdonik, who has no direct knowledge of the situation, said last month. Cree officials have said they plan to close the Ideal deal by the end of the fourth fiscal quarter, and it's a major milestone in Cree's pivot toward its power and radio frequency division, also known as Wolfspeed. Analysts have praised the lighting divestment, saying it creates a more focused company. State Senate approves controversial Duke Energy-backed bill on multi-year rates. This article written by John Downey. A Duke Energy-backed bill that would let regulators approve multi-year rate plans passed its final two votes in the state Senate Thursday and now heads to the House. The bill passed on second reading by a vote of 27 to 21. The third reading was a voice vote, so no separate vote tally is available. Supporters say the bill is just a tool for regulators to approve rates that can increase over 3 to 5 years the payment of costs for specified utility projects. The multi-year rates would have to be approved in a full rate case with an evidentiary hearing on the projects, but once the projects and rates are approved, less involved annual hearings to review the spending can be held and the rates adjusted without a full rate case. Opponents say the multi-year rates give too much power to utilities and will reduce the impact of the public as well as organized opponents. They contend it will lead to higher rates and could make it easier for Duke to charge customers for what could be $5.6 billion to $10.6 billion for coal ash pond closings and grid upgrades that could cost up to $13 billion over 10 years. The bill was bipartisan, with Senate Minority Leader Dan Blue, Democrat Wake, Deputy Senate President Pro Tem Ralph Heiss, Republican Mitchell, and Senator Bill Rabin, Republican Brunswick, as principal sponsors. Four Democrats joined blue and 22 Republican senators on the second reading to vote for approval. Four Republicans joined Senator Jerry Tillman, Republican Guilford, a vocal opponent of the bill, and 16 Democrats to vote in abjection of the bill. Senator Floyd McKissick, Democrat Durham, abstained, citing the statute on conflicts or potential conflicts of interest. He had been a critic of the bill in committee, but since then he has been nominated to the NC Utilities Commission by Governor Roy Cooper. That nomination must be approved by the Senate. Senate Bill 559 has two broad provisions. The first, highly detailed and largely non-controversial provision, gives the NC Utilities Commission the authority to approve utility proposed plans to sell bonds to pay for extraordinary storm costs. It is designed to deal with the kinds of problems Duke Energy Corporation experienced in 2018 when two hurricanes and a major winter storms racked up more than $600 million worth of damage in the Carolinas. The second provision, which is much shorter, involves the multi-year rate authority. The Utilities Commission would have the authority to approve or deny any proposed multi-year plan. It can also attach any conditions to the proposals to ensure that rates are just and reasonable. That second provision also allows the Commission to set a band on the return on equity that a utility can make on any project. It sets a limit on how much over or under the return allowed in the full rate case the utility would be able to earn in a given multi-year project without triggering a need to adjust the rates. Before the votes on the bill, Senator Mike Woodard, Democrat Durham, had proposed an amendment to soften the second to a proposal that the state's utility customer advocate conduct a study on the advisability of authorizing multi-year rate plans and banding of authorized returns. Only 17 legislators voted for the amendment. SAS's Goodnight reportedly named successor. This article written by Lauren Onasorge. SAS CEO Jim Goodnight is grooming Oliver Scheibenberger, CEO and CTO of the Cary Analytics Company, to be his replacement someday. That's according to what Goodnight reportedly told Bloomberg last week. Scheibenberger is already responsible for setting the technology direction for SAS and executing the company's strategic objectives and business priorities, according to the company, which has declined repeated requests to make him available for interviews. In 2017, he was handed a promotion that cut Goodnight's own direct reports in half. The then CTO was given the additional title of COO, reporting directly to Goodnight, a move that cut Goodnight's direct reports from 20 to 11. The move made him Goodnight's number two at the company, though the firm has repeatedly declined to say whether the position has put him next in line for the CEO role. And when he was promoted, a company spokeswoman was careful to point out that the news is not indicative of retirement plans for Jim Goodnight and should not be interpreted as such. Scheibenberger took on the CTO role in 2016. Scheibenberger had joined SAS in 2002. He is a fellow of the American Statistical Association and previously led the analytic server R&D division at SAS, overseeing the development of a scalable analytic server designed for visual analytics and visual statistics solutions. Prior to joining SAS, he served as assistant professor of statistics in the Crop and Soil Sciences Department at Michigan State University. Traditionally, SAS has released an annual report outlining its sales successes. Following the report, a top exec is typically made available for interviews. In 2019, that didn't happen. A spokeswoman said the report could be available in early May. In the meantime, the company's original eight named executives are dwindling. Following the planned June retirement of Chief Legal Officer John Boswell, Goodnight will be one of three still in office, alongside his co-founder John Saul, still an executive vice president, and Keith Collins, currently CIO at the company. Goodnight has not publicly announced any retirement plans. Wednesday, a SAS spokeswoman reiterated that Goodnight had no plans to retire. "He remains a very active CEO," says spokeswoman Shannon Heath. "The evolution of Oliver Scheibenberger's role has been part of SAS's long-term strategy for the company." Estate on Prime Raleigh Street to be sold at auction. This is written by Dane Huffman. A large estate on one of Raleigh's premier streets and connected to one of the city's best-known families has been padlocked and is scheduled to be auctioned this summer. The property at 2529 White Oak Road includes 2.97 acres and a 3,446-square-foot home built in 1938. The property has a tax value of $2.16 million. The home was owned by Celeste Gold Broughton until recently, when it was taken over by the court. She graduated from Vassar and married Robert Bain Broughton in 1964. He was the son of the late J. Melville Broughton, governor from 1941 to 1945, and a U.S. senator who died in office in 1949. According to court documents, the couple separated in 1968. A 2003 North Carolina Court of Appeals ruling notes, since that time, they have been involved in litigation. The White Oak Road property has a lengthy history in the courts. On December 15, 2017, U.S. District Judge Martin Redinger approved the trustees' right to sell the land and noted debts to the Wake County Revenue Department, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and others that totaled nearly $1 million. Then on June 25, Redinger ordered U.S. Marshals to seize the property because the debtor failed to vacate the premises. The property now appears headed toward an auction. Walter Hinson Jr. of Wilson, the trustee, says, at the moment, and it's subject to change, it appears we'll have an auction in the late summer in 90 days to 4 months. He says he has already had interest from investors who could keep the property as one lot or divide it into two or three lots. The area is zoned R2. This is unusual to have a parcel of property that is this desirable in one of Raleigh's most beautiful neighborhoods, Hinson says. He expects the auction to be held in a room at the old post office on Fayetteville Street in Raleigh. Bring your checkbook, Hinson says. Parker Hannifin to buy Carey's Lord Corporation for $3.7 billion. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Ohio industrial giant Parker Hannifin Corporation is acquiring Carey-based Lord Corporation in a $3.7 billion deal. The deal, which has been approved by the boards of both companies, is expected to close within the next 4 to 6 months. At close, the company will become part of Parker's Engineered Materials Group. According to a statement from Parker, Lord will strengthen its offerings in core aerospace and defense, high-value automotive, and industrial markets. Lord, founded in 1924, develops adhesives, coatings, and specialty materials, as well as vibration and motion control technologies. The company, which recently inked its biggest deal yet to develop a new cockpit control system for Boeing, has annual sales of about $1.1 billion, employing 3,100 across 17 manufacturing and 15 research and development facilities across the globe. Ed Auslander, Lord's CEO, couldn't immediately be reached to comment further on the deal, but in a prepared statement, he said Parker's complementary business segments would enable the company to carry out our grander vision. Parker is already a large Tier 1 supplier in many areas, allowing our business lines immediate access to growth, additional markets, applications, and new customers, Auslander states. In addition, the two companies are very much aligned when it comes to core values, great business acumen, and cultural fit. Lord will significantly expand our material science capabilities with complementary products, better positioning us to serve customers in growth industries and capitalize on emerging trends such as electrification and lightweighting, stated Tom Williams, chairman and CEO of Park, in his own prepared statement. This transaction will meaningfully transform our portfolio, he says. Parker plans to finance the deal using new debt. Parker expects to realize about $125 million in pre-tax run rate cost synergies by 2023. Few specifics were immediately available, but the company said in a release that the synergies would come from the implementation of strategy initiatives such as supply chain and lean productivity and SG&A. It's not the first deal with a big North Carolina touchpoint for Parker. In 2017, Parker bought a Tennessee company called Clarcor, which had a manufacturing plant in Washington, North Carolina. Within a few months, the company announced it would be shuttering that plant, a move that meant 220 layoffs. But the company still has a sizable presence in North Carolina. The company's electromechanical and drives division is headquartered in Charlotte, and its aerospace filtration division runs out of a site in Greensboro. NIH grant propels forward NC State spinout. This article written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Thanks to a $3 million federal grant, one NC State University spinout says it has a clear runway ahead towards commercialization of its product. Nirvana Sciences, a Research Triangle Park-based company, whose name is a play on near-infrared, has received a $3 million grant from the National Institutes of Health. The company is developing a class of red and near-infrared fluorescent dyes that increase the performance of flow cytometers, medical devices used to gauge the body's immune system. The company hopes by developing the advanced dyes, researchers will be able to run more complex experiments using cytometers. CEO Russell Thomas said the new funding will be used to accelerate development, bringing commercialization of the product as near as this fall. With the funding and an ongoing Series B fundraising round, he said the company has about a three-year runway. Past that, Thomas said the company is likely looking to license its product out instead of attempting to run a sales operation. "We're a classic technology development company," he said. "Basically, de-risk the technology initially with partners to prove the commercial value of it, and then let a large manufacturer acquire the technology and take it global. Between that exit plan and now, however, is proving the commercial value." Thomas said their biggest challenge in the coming months was finding an initial commercial partner as well as scaling up their operations to meet anticipated demand. The company just recently moved its headquarters to a new facility in RTP at the Alexandria Innovation Center, which Thomas said will give the company room to expand their operations. Currently, only 6 full-time employees work for the company, with few additional hires planned. Nirvana was launched in 2011. In addition to the NIH grant, it has received support from angel investors and the North Carolina Biotech Center. And in an exclusive story, Cincinnati real estate company enters Raleigh. This is written by Tom Demaropoulos of the Cincinnati Business Courier. One of Greater Cincinnati's largest and most active commercial real estate developers has entered its fourth market. Al Nayer has entered Raleigh and appointed Justin Parker to serve as Vice President of Real Estate Development and lead Al Nayer's presence in the region. Molly North, president and CEO of Al Nayer, said the company identified Raleigh for expansion because of the market's momentum and opportunity to expand its footprint in another dynamic market. She said the region's population growth in particular made it attractive. "What we really like about Raleigh is in a time of what I term the talent wars, Raleigh is producing about 70,000 graduates on an annual basis." Parker will be responsible for creating business solutions and partnerships, representing the company's integrated process and supporting Al Nayer's pipeline and expansion into a new market. "Justin is a critical part of this initiative. He has the local experience to help Al Nayer establish trusted relationships in the area and the real estate know-how to execute exciting development and design-build opportunities," North said. Parker has more than 15 years of experience in commercial real estate finance and business development. Most recently, he served as Senior Director of Southeast Development at Wexford Science and Technology. Al Nayer is a commercial real estate developer and design builder that specializes in urban mixed-use developments and build-to-suit commercial spaces, including custom office spaces, medical office buildings, industrial facilities, and multi-unit residential. North said she sees opportunity in each of those sectors in Raleigh. Al Nayer plans to open a physical office in Raleigh, with plans to eventually grow the office to 12 to 15 employees in the next 3 years. Its offices in Pittsburgh and Nashville each have about a dozen employees. It opened its Nashville office in 2015. Founded in Cincinnati in 1894, Al Nayer became employee-owned in 2014. Its current projects include the 8th and Main Luxury Apartment Tower in downtown Cincinnati, the 1.7 million square foot Erlanger Commerce Center Industrial Park, 3 medical office buildings for Premier Health, a 900,000 square foot distribution center in Lebanon, Tennessee, and Innovation Point, a 90,000 square foot Class A office building in Marshall Township, Pennsylvania. Spirit CEO, 7 RDU destinations is just the beginning. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Ted Christie, CEO of Florida ultra-low-cost carrier Spirit Airlines, doesn't make a practice of attending a service launch. Spirit Celebration at Raleigh-Durham International Airport was actually his first such appearance, despite several recent market debuts. "This is a big launch for us," he says in an interview. "And it's so big that the seven flights that are part of Spirit's market debut, Baltimore, Boston, Detroit, Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, New Orleans, and Chicago, are likely just the start," he says. "I think we're going to create some brand awareness, and then we'll see where it goes," he says, noting that the Latin American and Caribbean markets, which Spirit has labeled part of its long-term international strategy, could be a good fit. Already, the debut gives RDU flyers 27 options, including connection flights, and that includes international destinations, such as recently announced connections to Colombia. And while much of Spirit's international focus has been on airports in its home turf of Fort Lauderdale and Orlando, Spirit has been expanding its international leisure offerings in other cities, such as Detroit, Houston, Baltimore, and Chicago. "There may be an opportunity to do some of that here in Raleigh," he says, "and much of that growth could happen at Terminal 1, likely Spirit's eventual location, though it made its debut in Terminal 2. I think that's where the growth of the airport will be, at least in the near term," he says. "In the nearer term, for us to be able to continue to pursue growth opportunities, I think it will come, probably, in Terminal 1. Christie says Spirit's biggest RDU competition won't be competing carriers, firms such as Frontier Airlines and Allegiant Air that have also been aggressively trying to reel in leisure travelers. It's other activities, such as nice dinners and concerts. Your challenge is, how do they spend their discretionary dollars on travel?" He says, "Your biggest competitor is that decision point." As for the timing of the rollout, Christie says Raleigh has always been on the list and that real estate constraints at the airport have been a factor. But Christie says that even when Spirit launched service at Piedmont Triad International Airport in the fall, officials were in late-stage negotiations for RDU. "We found this opportunity to get started, and we believe there's a growth opportunity here," he says. And we'll stop there, as the article just points out that Spirit will make its Charlotte debut in June. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.